Mark. If you remember back a few weeks ago before Easter, we were making our way really well through the gospel right up to somewhere around chapter 12. And then we said, we're going to kind of have a bit of a deal here where we're going to kind of stop where we were at in the gospel of Mark so that we could come to the great story of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection as we came through the Easter season. And I promised we would come back to chapter 13. I made a few wisecracks about it, but I did promise we would come back and deal with this passage. Now, if you're new to church, and so you're kind of going, what on earth, you know, what's the big deal, Mark chapter 13? Has nothing to do with the number. It's not like we consider it bad luck or anything like that. It's just Mark chapter 13 contains some verses and some ideas that have been much debated. There's been just a lot of back and forth struggle to understand exactly what these verses mean that Jesus speaks throughout this book. And so I'm going to do my best to teach this morning what I become convinced is the message of this passage. If you disagree with me, please be generous. Don't throw things. You can talk to me afterwards. You can send me emails. Please don't make them nasty. I'd love to chat more. I am well aware that probably within this room and within our church family, we have some different ways of wrestling through some of these things. Here's what I hope, at a bare minimum, we can agree on. That when Jesus makes a claim, it does come true every time. I mess up an announcement I said in the early service. I thought I was batting 1,000 until Bob came and helped me realize that. Jesus bats 1,000 every time. And he's coming back. That I have no doubt, and I believe that's a part of what our church family believes together, that he has in fact died for our sins, he has been in fact raised from the dead, he has ascended to heaven, and one day he will return, and it will be a glorious day because Paul tells us that he comes back to be marveled at by those who believe, and I just thank Paul for that description. He does not come back to satisfy our curiosity or to answer our questions, although I suspect that there will be some fantastic answers. He comes back so that we can just marvel at the Son of God and his infinite power and wisdom and love and compassion and holiness. And then there's some other things that we probably are going to have to wrestle through and try to understand together. And we might think differently. And perhaps some things in chapter 13 of Mark will be that territory. All I just ask is that we continue to love each other as we do that. Now, before we get to chapter 13, we just want to just spend a couple minutes at the end of chapter 12. And this isn't to delay the inevitable. It's just because when we were in chapter 12, we didn't finish the chapter. And there's a great scene right at the end of the chapter that I want to make sure that we just at least consider briefly. I will warn you, we're going to have to move quickly. I got through about half the sermon in the early service, and a few people in the lobby said, could you preach like about another 3 weeks on that? To which the answer is no, we're going to move into Hosea next week because it's Mother's Day, and what better book than Hosea to think about for Mother's Day, of God's incredible love for all of us. But particularly next week, we'll be thinking about God's great love for moms. But at the end of Mark chapter 12, there's an interesting transition. So all through chapter 12, Jesus has been asked very difficult questions. The scribes, the Pharisees gather together. In my mind's eye, I picture them spending days, maybe weeks, trying to come up with the perfect question so that when they answer it, Jesus either has to back himself into some sort of difficult theological corner and make a claim that he doesn't want to make so that they can get him in trouble, or they can expose him and somehow show him to be a fool. But every time they ask him a question, he responds with the most genius, brilliant answers ever to come from the lips of a person to walk this earth. And so eventually we get to this great verse 34. When they've heard his answers and they hear every time he answers wisely, and they decide, we dare not ask him another question. Because rather than showing him to be the fool, every time we ask the question he answers, it's us that ends up looking foolish. Because it shows more and more our failure to understand who God is. And so, for the first time, after verse 34, Jesus seems to get a blank slate. There's no incident he's responding to. There's no question he's answering. There's no scene that he's having to somehow explain or summarize. It feels like to me, one of the first times in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus just gets to say whatever it is that he really, really wants to say to us. Right? There's nothing he has to respond to here. And I guess I wonder to myself, if Jesus had that opportunity, what would he pick? Maybe he would go back and he would start talking about the fact that he had gone into Jerusalem, this triumphant entry, but no one had acknowledged the fact that he was the king. Maybe he would want to talk about the fact that he had done great miracles that were intended for signs that were supposed to open the eyes of the people, but because of the hardness of their heart, they just kept denying it all, even though they saw it with their own eyes. Or maybe he would want to choose this moment to speak out about, you know, some of the great social sin ills of the day. I mean, what's going on in the city of Jerusalem is pretty horrific at this time. We tend to look sort of through sanitized glasses of what we expect to happen in the temple worship. It might surprise us to find that even in the temple in Jerusalem, cultic ritual prostitution was being practiced. I mean, these people who knew better, because God's word was so clear, were engaged in some of the things that we think, that's not what followers of God do. They were killing each other, even amongst the priests. They were murdering one another to try to gain, you know, political advantage and economic advantage. You think maybe this is the moment where Jesus is going to say, look, enough. Let me tell you about some of the sins that need to stop. Well, if you think like I do on some of those things, it probably comes as a surprise when we read what he chooses to single out. And here's what he says in verse 38. Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and like greetings in the marketplace. They have the best seats in the synagogue and the place of honor at the feasts. They devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. They will receive great condemnation. Surprise you? It does me. Beware of people who pray for a long time, who want to sit at the front in church. Right? Beware of those people. Why? Because pride had crept into their hearts and was rotting them from the inside out. And Jesus said, even more dangerous than these other sinful things, even more important to speak of at this moment where I get a blank slate to just choose whatever I need to speak about, he says, this is the issue. Pride will kill you. He says, beware of those who devour widows' houses. Isn't that an interesting one? He's saying something like this. Beware of taking advantage of people that you view as less than you, people created and formed in the image of God to bear his image. Beware of people who treat them like nothing as a means to their own end. Then he does something even more strange. He sat down, verse 41, opposite the treasury and watched people putting money into the offering box. Now, at the temple, there were 13 boxes. They weren't exactly boxes. That's probably not a great description. They were containers that actually looked somewhat like a trumpet. And as people came to worship God at the temple, they would come not very often. So not like we would come every week to church. They would come on occasion to Jerusalem for a feast or a festival. And at this point, they're coming up to the Feast of Passover. So a lot of people would have been coming. They would bring their offerings. So the amounts of money are usually quite significant because it's a fairly rare thing when they would give. And Jesus parks himself right in front of one of these boxes. Now, for us, the modern equivalent would be if our ushers came and took up the offering, Jesus would have followed the usher along, watching what you put in the plate. You go, well, that's kind of different. And then he watches what takes place. Many rich people put in large sums. And a poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which make a penny. Now, I did the math this week because I was kind of curious. So what is that? It's about, in our terms, it's about 5 minutes of work at minimum wage. Right? It's an amount so small that you just, it's the smallest currency available to her. It's not much. That's what's going on in this story. On the one hand, rich people coming with a whole bunch of resources, and then a poor woman with two small pennies. And Jesus called his disciples, verse 43, to himself, and he said, truly I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the offering box. Did you hear that? Does that blow your math skills right out of the water? Now, had he said something like this, this poor widow has put in relatively more, if you factor in the fact that these people are wealthy and give out of their wealth and she gives out of her poverty. And so if we compare the two, it's her sacrifice is bigger. Had it been that, I would have said, well, that makes sense. I can understand. She has nothing and she gives. That's not what he says. He says, if you put all the money in two piles, the pile of all the wealthy people who just came, stack it all up, and then you put her two coins in another pile, hers is bigger. That's what he says, literally, right off the page. She gave more. I don't know about you. That's not how I learned to do math. And what it says to me is that God has a very different way of counting than we do. And if we look back into this previous few verses when Jesus warned about those who would take advantage of widows, there seems to be something important in that statement that perhaps God has a totally different sense of judging worth of people. We might look down at some that we look and say, you know what, they're poor or they're weak or they're vulnerable, so they don't count as much in our world. But those who are prominent and wealthy and important, well, they have more value. God just says, that's just not how it works. Not in my mind. We need to be very careful. We pay attention to this little scene. Jesus goes on and says, they all contributed out of their abundance, but she out of her poverty has put in everything she had and all she had to live on. Now we want to get on to chapter 13, but here's what occurs to me as I read that, and maybe you want to think about it a little bit too. As I read that, I think to myself, as I give to this local church, to other things, my giving, however else I figure it out and whatever I decide to give, my giving must affect my lifestyle. It seems to be the principle coming out of this. The wealthy gave, but it didn't affect them. But this poor woman, what she gave, it was so much of what she had that it changed the way in which she lived. And I think that's a great principle upon which to kind of gauge of what I ought to be giving. It has to at least affect how I live my life, because I want to show the worth and value of God, and it's one way I can do it, by giving. Now, we weren't in chapter 12. That's just bonus. And as you can already see, we're going to be hard-pressed. So buckle up. We're going to make our best run through this chapter and hopefully answer more questions than we create, although that might be ambitious. Here we go. The disciples leave with Jesus in chapter 13. Remember, they've been at the temple, they've stood in front of these offering plates, and now they leave, and here's the scene that unfolds before us. As he came out of the temple, verse 1, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and wonderful buildings." That's a good comment. I mean, just so you can kind of picture it, if you've ever seen a picture of the Temple Mount in Israel, it's a massive structure, really, is all it is today. There's no buildings that are there today that were there at this point in history. But it was a great elevated platform, basically like a giant retaining wall on four sides, elevating a massive platform the size of many football fields. And on top of that platform, massive buildings were built. It was the place where the nation of Israel came to worship God. In fact, we know from archaeology and history, some of the stones used, you remember they point out, what great stones. You think, why would they point that out? I mean, the dome of the temple was covered in gold. Why didn't they say, what a great shiny roof, or something along that? No, what stands out to them is these stones. Well, we know that some of the stones were actually 46 feet, this is the biggest one, 46 feet long, 12 feet tall, and 8 feet thick. We don't even know how they got them up there, let alone how they ever used them to build anything. I mean, it's just a colossal structure that they built. And so the disciples made a pretty good comment. Jesus, this is an incredible thing. They walk out of the temple. They're going up the hill on the other side. They turn back and they say to Jesus, "Would you look at that? That is truly an impressive sight." And Jesus says to them, "Do you see these great buildings? There will not be left here one stone standing on another that will not be thrown down." Don't miss that. That's the prophetic statement of the chapter. Oh, I see that great building. And you see those great stones? There won't even be two left stacked. Now, that is an amazing thing to say. For two different reasons. One, just trying to destroy a building of that magnitude is quite a substantial project. I mean, it took years and years to build the thing. What kind of enemy nation is going to come in trying to destroy Israel and take all the time and effort to destroy a building of that size and magnitude? Why not just kind of wreck it a little bit or take it over and use it for your own purpose? But Jesus says, no, there will come a day where actually that building will be completely undone. Let me just, in case you don't know, 40 years later, in the year 70 AD, Rome will march in. And Titus will not be satisfied just to destroy the Jewish people. He will actually order his troops to wipe the surface of the Temple Mount clean. He will do exactly what Jesus prophesied would happen. Now, that's the one reason it's pretty amazing, because who does that? Who takes the time? On the other hand, the reason it's amazing is because these are Jewish people who believed that was impossible. After all, if you have read through the Old Testament at all, you would understand that if you're going to worship God, you come and you do it at the temple. That's where it happens. What happens if there's no more temple? There's no more worship of God. That seemed to be an impossibility. And so the Jewish people had developed this pretty simple faith that whatever else might happen in their nation, whether Rome came or other invaders came, the one thing that would not be undone is the temple. God would make sure that he protected it. In fact, they were so convinced of it when Rome finally did come, they all hid in the temple, absolutely convinced that Rome might destroy the city, but surely God would stop them at the gates of the temple. And they were all killed. And Jesus suggests to a Jewish person would have been unfathomable. That building will be utterly destroyed. I don't know what goes on in a conversation between the disciples as they walk along the path. Like, did he just say what I think he said? I mean, surely this must be a parable. Remember this parable? What could he have meant? What does the stone mean? And I don't know if that's what happens, but by the time they walk up the other side of the Mount of Olives, four of them, Peter, James, John, and Andrew, take him aside privately and say, "Tell us, when will these things happen? And what will be the signs? Like, give us the indicators that this is about to happen, because surely there'll be something that we're going to notice." For the rest of the chapter, that's the question Jesus is answering. Now, right here, and this is where things get a little bit tricky, good, God-loving, Bible-believing Christians have differed a little bit on where the rest of this chapter goes. I mean, I grew up in a time, just sort of for full disclosure, where sort of the end times was a pretty hot topic. It was sort of coming out of the Hal Lindsey era. And I still remember, does anyone remember the 88 reasons why Jesus will come back in 1988? There's a couple in the early service who did, a few of us did, and it's followed up by the next hit of 89 reasons why he will come back in 89. I kid you not. And it was a pamphlet in 1990 of why Jesus will come back in 1990, right? By then, you don't buy the book. You know? And I kid you not, it was alive and well. It was thriving. I just grew up terrified of this kind of stuff because I've got a great imagination that kept me awake at night, you know, sweating bullets over the whole, what is this going to look like? And I just hit a point in my life where I just said, you know what? Anything I do think about this scares me. And when I open up God's word to try to understand it, I can't see what I'm being told, so clearly I can't understand it. So rather than wrestle through it and be scared all the time, I'll just stop. Right? There's all sorts of other great places in God's word that we can read. There's great, great stories, great teachings. Let's just read those. Leave these ones aside. And sadly, quite a few years went on before I finally decided, you know what? I'm pretty sure this is important. You know, it's one of the, in fact, in the Gospel of Mark, it's one of the longest extended teachings where Jesus speaks, is this chapter. This stuff must matter. So I've spent a little while trying to wrestle through it, and I wanted to share a little bit of how I wrestled through this chapter with you here this morning. Now, there's four options of what we're going to do with this chapter. Some people say the chapter is only about the temple. All right? So if you were to read through it, they would say everything that comes after this is a response to that question, and that's it. Other people say, well, actually, you know, when we read through it, it sounds like there's a little more going on than that. It sounds like Jesus is starting to talk about the fact that he's going to come back. Like, there's some bigger things happening. And so they say, you know what, maybe what's going on is Jesus is talking about the temple and his return. And every time he says one thing, it actually has something to do with both. And so you have to try to sort your way through this thing. Other people have said, well, he's talking about the temple and he's talking about his return, but he keeps switching. And so you have to kind of figure out which he's talking about. That's that third option. The fourth one, and what I'm going to suggest, where I've kind of landed, is that he is speaking predominantly about the temple. It's mainly a response to the question in verse 5. But at some point, quite far into the chapter, I'm going to suggest around verse 31 or 32, he switches subjects and begins to speak about the fact that he will return. All right, so there's sort of the full disclosure. Now you know where I'm coming from. And if you want to wrestle this out with me later, I'm game. I'm just not very well equipped. Now let me explain why I get there. Jesus began to say to them, "See that no one leads you astray." This is verse 5. "Many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he.' They will lead many astray. And when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is not yet." All right, so you hear what he's doing. They're coming and saying, "Jesus, tell us the signs." And he starts by saying, these aren't the signs. See how that works? He's saying these things will happen, but they're not the signs. He goes on and then he says in verse 8, nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. These are but the beginnings of the birth pains. So he's sort of saying, okay, these things will happen, but they're not the signs I really want to point you to. They are sort of like the things that come before the signs. So be careful with this, because every once in a while, and I've done it myself, so I'm as guilty as the next guy. I watch CNN and I see tsunamis and earthquakes and I go, wow, maybe this is the signs. And Jesus says, well, you know, pay attention to those things. Don't totally ignore that stuff. But that's not the important thing. We're going to get to it when he gets to about verse 14. He goes on, and then he says to them, be on your guard. They will deliver you over to councils. You will be beaten in synagogues. You will stand before governors and kings for my sake to bear witness before them. Now that is just simply the book of Acts. That's exactly what happens in the lives of some of these very men who stand there and hear Jesus say this. They stand before councils. They are put on trial. They are beaten. Some of them are killed because of the gospel witness they're making. So I think everything up to now, Jesus is saying, you know what? One day the temple will be destroyed. These things are going to happen between now and then. But don't let them send you into a panic. Be aware, but don't panic. Don't be misled. There will be wars. There will be famines. There will be earthquakes. There will be people who will die for my sake because of the witness they're making. And then in verse 10, he makes an incredible statement. The gospel must first be proclaimed to all the nations. Right before the temple is destroyed, the gospel must be proclaimed. Now that one, I know some of you are saying, well, we want to see what you do with that one, because surely you can't tell me the gospel was proclaimed to the whole earth before 70 AD. Well, I'm not going to proclaim it, but Paul does. In fact, Paul is very clear throughout the things he writes that in his understanding, in his estimation, the gospel was in fact proclaim. Listen to what he writes to the Romans before this takes place. Here's what he says. I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you, because your faith is proclaimed in all of the world. A little later, he says, I have asked, have they not heard? Indeed they have, for their voice has gone out to all the earth, their words to the end of the world. Listen to what he says to the Colossians. The gospel which has come to you, as indeed in the whole world, is bearing fruit and growing. A little bit later, he says this to them. The gospel which you have heard was preached to every creature under heaven. You see, in Paul's understanding, the gospel has gone out to whatever it is he understands the whole world to be. That's why the early church is so certain Jesus can come back at any time. They're not looking and saying, well, Jesus has to come back after the gospel's preached to the whole world, and clearly it's not, so he can't come back. Because that's where we end up if we read verse 10 as I had always read it. And yet the Bible clearly teaches Jesus can come back at any moment. I don't think there'd be a single one of us who would disagree with that. So what's going on here? Well, when we read it through the lens that Jesus would have clearly intended it and his disciples would have understood it, they would have just simply realized, you know what? The gospel is going to be preached to the whole known world, the Roman Empire, this thing that we call the world. Paul comes along, and what does he do? He takes the gospel to the whole world. Now, lest you think that's a lesser thing, you're going, hold on, this feels like cheating. That doesn't feel like a very monumental thing. Shouldn't it have to get to the whole world? Now, hear me real clear on this one. I absolutely believe that we are called to fulfill the Great Commission. I don't think we have an ounce of excuse for not taking the gospel to the farthest corners of the world. It's what we're called to do in obedience to Jesus Christ. I just don't think that's what's going on here. Think for a second of how amazing this is, that the early church, this group of non-resourced, that's what we'll call them, that's what you call, you know, people who have nothing today. They're under-resourced. They had nothing. They were impoverished people, mainly unskilled. They were certainly unarmed. Basically, one of them took the gospel to the whole world. Think of how unlikely that is. Imagine if we just said, you know what, this morning we're going to choose one of us. We're going to send one person from this room, and your job is to go to all the great cities of the world and start a church. And if you could do it in the next 20 years, that'd be great. We go, that's impossible. It's never going to happen. Can't be done. I mean, one person may be going to one city in 20 years, maybe plants one church. Think of the miracle that takes place that Paul is able to do this, that the Spirit of God works through him, that verse is able to be spoken of as though it's true, that the gospel's gone to the whole world because he plants church in city after city after city. in an incredibly short time span, the gospel was proclaimed. And he goes on and he describes the fact that they're going to be handed over, that some terrible things are going to happen, that there'll be all sorts of uprising and turmoil, that they're going to be hated. But he ends by saying, the one who endures, verse 14 or 13, will be saved. And what I want to suggest to you is up to now, everything that happened in those verses took place between the time Jesus died and the time the temple's destroyed in 70 AD. Then in verse 14, we come to a turning point. Now my Bible has the word but at the start of verse 14, and there's another one at the start of verse 32. I don't think NIV has it. It's unfortunate because it's really there in the Greek. They just sort of dropped it because I guess it's cumbersome to read it. The but there helps us understand that the subject has changed ever so slightly. He's been talking about sort of the signs before the signs, and now he says, now I'm going to tell you, here's the big one. This is the one to pay attention for. If you want to know when the temple's going to be destroyed, don't miss this one. Here's what he says. When you see the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not to be, in brackets, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, because it's about to happen. I would have to say, that one doesn't sound quite as clear. The abomination of, when you see it standing. Now, historically, they would have understood exactly what Jesus was referring to. Because in the year 168 to 170, sort of right in that era, there had been a king over Israel, Antiochus Epiphanes. He had gone to Egypt fighting a military campaign. Well, there, a rumor spread in Israel that he had been killed. And so the Jewish people decided, you know what, if we have no king, now's a great time to rise up and to throw off these foreign oppressors because the king's gone. The only problem was he hadn't died. And he came home. And when he heard what they did, he decided, enough is enough. I'm going to annihilate the citizens of Jerusalem. He basically depopulates his capital city in 3 days, kills 80,000 men, women, and children. Just annihilates them. And then he comes to his leading wise men and he says, tell me what will be the most offensive thing we could possibly do to these people. They come back to him with this answer. If you were to go into their temple and sacrifice a pig, that's about as bad as it could get. He does that exact thing. And it's come to understand as a fulfillment of a prophecy out of Daniel. And they all understand that that's the abomination of desolation. Here's the problem. We're almost 190 years after that. So what does Jesus mean? Now, most people will say, well, probably what he means is that there's going to be something similar to that. Hey, that's what took place a while ago. And so maybe what he's saying is that when you see something like that, that's your clue that the temple's about to be destroyed. Now, historically, there's three things that look kind of like that. The first is when Caligula, the emperor of Rome, he again talks to his sort of leading men, and they decide, you know what, we want to offer a sacrifice in the temple. We're going to desecrate the temple of the Jews. He's just sort of a twisted, broken man. There was no particular reason. He just dreamt it up one day. The only problem is he never actually goes through with it. So if the point is when you see it standing where it ought not to be, Caligula comes really close to fulfillment of that prophecy, but he never follows through. The second idea that's been suggested is the year 68 when the zealots occupy the temple, do a whole bunch of really bad things, hoping to incite a civil war. The only problem is that the civil war never comes. And the things that they do don't really come close. I mean, they're still Jews. There's only so far they're willing to go in the desecration of the temple. And they won't do the things like that have happened 190 years earlier. The third suggestion is that it's actually Titus who actually is the one responsible for destroying the temple. And after the destruction of the temple, he comes with his standard, the big Roman flags, plants it right in the middle of the temple. And they look and say, well, that's kind of sacrilegious. That's an image in the middle of the temple. The only problem is that's a bad sign. If you're saying, here's the sign, it's about to happen, but the sign comes after, it's actually not really a sign. You understand? Like, it was too late. Now, that doesn't help you flee because it's all over by then and everyone's dead. So what do we do? And what is the sign? Because this is the big one. This is the one he's saying. This is the important one. This is the sign that it's about to happen. Well, there's one little statement. You see it in brackets if you got your Bible open. Let the reader understand. And whenever you read that in Scripture, that's like a code statement for saying what you initially think might not be right. Now, when you read that and you just think, oh, I understand exactly what that's about. It's Daniel. It's Antiochus Epiphanes. That's just sort of a little help to help us know that maybe we need to think a little further. And when we do that, something very interesting happens. When we go looking in the Old Testament for anything else that might bear some resemblance, we come to one other passage. It's in Jeremiah chapter 7. Again, it's a prophecy from Jeremiah where God speaks to the people of Israel, and here's what he says to them. Stand in the gate of the Lord's house. This is his instruction to Jeremiah. And proclaim this word. Say, hear the word of the Lord, all you men of Judah who enter these gates to worship the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your deeds, and I will let you dwell in this place. Do not trust these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord. See, that's what they were trusting, and they believed that because this was the temple of the Lord, it was guaranteed to never be destroyed and to be safe. But God says, don't trust those words. For if you truly amend your ways and your deeds, if you truly execute justice with one another, if you do not oppress the sojourner, the fatherless, or the widow, does that not sound like the end of chapter 12 where Jesus says, the one thing that's breaking my heart is that you are mistreating widows. Then I will let you dwell in this place in the land I gave of old to your fathers. Behold, you trust in deceptive words to no avail. You steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known. And then you come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and you say, we are delivered, only to go on doing these same abominations. What's Jeremiah saying? Almost word for word what chapter 12 points us to. Widows being oppressed, the leaders of the religious movement within Judaism taking advantage of others and seeking their own gain and own profit at the expense of the honor of God. And Jeremiah tells us that is an abomination, exactly the same word back to Mark chapter 13. That's an abomination to God. So what's Jesus saying? Disciples, when you see the very leaders of the Jewish faith making a mockery of God in their own temple, run. It's not about Rome. It's never been about Rome. The problem is not some foreign oppressor that we need to throw off. The problem is your own system of thinking this is how you encounter God. It is broken. And God's going to come in and judge and destroy his own temple to clear the way for a new way of coming to know him through his Son. That's the abomination. He goes on and he speaks about it for a little bit there in the following few verses. Now, here's where things are going to get tricky because we've got like 5 minutes left and we're halfway through the chapter. Let me point out a couple quick things that we bring it in for landing. Verse 24 through about 20-30 get hard for us. You have to read Old Testament prophecy to understand the language that's going on. It's not a futuristic thing at all. This is Isaiah 13 and Zechariah 2, almost word for word quotation. This is the way that the prophets spoke when the judgment of God was coming. And if you go and read those passages and then read what Jesus says, you'll understand that what he's talking about is the judgment that comes in AD 70 when the temple's destroyed. He goes on and he actually says to them, this generation will not pass away until these things happen. 40 years later, that generation had not passed away and they witnessed these very things. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I do believe by verse 32 something different happens. In fact, it's marked by that word but, and it's also marked by an interesting little turn of phrase where Jesus says, concerning that day. Now, up to now, if you go back to verse 24, he's been talking about those days. Those days when the temple is destroyed. Here's what they're going to look like. Here's how you know they're coming. That's those days. But there's another day coming. And concerning that day. That day when the Son of God will descend from the clouds and stand on earth. Concerning that day, no one knows the time. Don't buy the books. Don't listen to the preachers. Ignore them. That's not my words. That's not my encouragement. That's Jesus. No one knows the time. So don't waste your money or your time trying to figure it out. Instead, Jesus says, just make sure you keep yourself ready. Because he could come back at any time. What does readiness look like? Well, I think that's why I take my cue from what Paul says. Readiness looks like we are prepared to marvel at his appearing. It means that we don't fill our thoughts just with scholarly activities to try to wrestle and sort out and figure and connect the dots. We make sure that our hearts are inflamed with a love for Jesus Christ, not just a curiosity about information. Make sure your heart's ready to marvel at his appearing, not just your mind ready to answer questions and to wrestle through stimulating things. I think there's a reason why Mark comes next to the story he does of a woman named Mary who comes and takes a vial of perfume and breaks it at the feet of Jesus and anoints him with a vast, vast gift. It's because Mark wants us to understand that in the midst of all this wrestling, on all these questions, all these struggles, all these debates that we're going to have that are good and interesting and hopefully profitable for us as we come to encourage one another in our confidence that Jesus is returning, we never stop worshiping him. We never stop. We begin with a woman who puts two pennies in because it's all she has because she's worshiping God. We end with a woman who takes her great treasure and pours it out at the feet of Jesus because she is worshiping God. In the middle, we're reminded of these simple things. Jesus predicted what no one else was suggesting. I mean, don't kid yourself. It's not like Jesus was predicting the temple would be destroyed along with 100 other people. He was the lone voice. And everything he said would happen, happened. You got to think really carefully if you want to bet against that, particularly because of the thing he promises next. Concerning that day, no one knows, but that day will come. So stay awake.